Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to this. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. It is the Rugby Dungeon and we are back again. Well, I say again, this is the first interview I've done for a while. Had a few hardware issues, but I am pleased to inform you that I've got Mark Evans next week, and also an interview with Rob Kitson, which I just need to cut together. But before we do any of that, one of my favourite guests, my only ever returning guest, the big man himself, the guy who David Flatman refers to as having animal strength, Carl Ferns. How are you, mate?
I'm good, JB. Well, thanks. I'm honoured to be the only one to come back. Thanks for that. I'm currently just drinking a glass of red and eating a few salt and vinegar sticks.
So, nice.
Nice. Good to go.
Living the continental life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I know one of the most boring questions, and every podcast is asking it at the moment, how are you dealing with lockdown? But I guess we must get it out of the way, because you are still in lockdown, right?
Yeah, well, I was in lockdown in France, luckily in my house, because a few of the lads were in the apartments in the city. And so luckily I had a garden for the kids to run around in, and so I was there. But I'm back in the UK now.
Who are you?
Yeah, because I'm obviously leaving Lyon, and my family's going to be living back in the UK now. So I'm trying to sort out a house for them and all the serious stuff, the big boy stuff.
Where are you moving back to? Are you going back up to the northeast? Because obviously you're from the northwest, but you're going to northeast. Is that right?
Yeah. So I wanted to live in Cheshire Way, but Rachel's going to get away, and we're going to set a base up in the northeast. And so I'm currently looking at trying to find houses up there at the minute.
Yeah. Now, for people who aren't following you that closely over in the UK, just tell us a little bit now about your situation, because you were with Lyon and you've decided not to stay with Lyon. You had the option to, but you decided against it.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a weird contract negotiations, obviously, because first of all, you had the Sarri's scandal thing come out, and then clubs were, a bit worried about, what they're going to do with Sarri cap, and, a lot of indecision there. And then you had another thing I forgot now, but you had another thing, and then you've obviously had COVID as well, which is, again, stopping a lot of the clubs doing business. Going back to Lyon, it was quite a, it's a weird one, because they were saying that, they want to keep me, and verbally they were saying that they're going to keep me, and I didn't really get anything offered in front of me. So then I just thought, oh well, after what I've done for the club and how long I've been there for, I just felt that was a bit disrespectful. I love my time at Lyon, and I've got nothing to, not bagging them, but I just felt that was a little bit disrespectful. And, for me, that was probably the time for me to go then.
It's an interesting time that you've had at Lyon, because, obviously when you join a club, things are said, such as we have ambition, we're going to do this. If you look at any promoted club into the Premiership, for instance, I think with the exception of maybe Bristol and Exeter, they all have big plans and they all fail. But Lyon had big plans and they actually managed to hit most of their targets.
Yeah, well, I'm proud of what we've done at Lyon, because, you look, we went from, it was a yo-yo club, really. That we're going up and down, top 14 to the Pro D2, and I went there and, not just me, but all the players that we've had and who've left now as well and contributed to that. And we, you know, we not only kept them in the top 14, but we were in two, you know, I was in two semi-finals as well with them. Although I didn't play in a couple of them because I was injured at the time. But, you know, from going from Prodi there, I think we finished maybe 10th in the first season, and then we kicked on to two semi-finals. So I'm ultimately really proud of what we've done there.
Yeah, because I mentioned at the very start of the podcast, I've just done an interview with Mark Evans, who's a fascinating chap. And obviously, he's been CEO at Harlequins, and he's co-authored a book as well about, you know, the future of rugby. And he points out that in the UK, the game has been professional for God knows how long. And something which I've never really thought of, the game has never really penetrated any of these bigger cities. Like, there's no team in Birmingham, is there? There's no team from your hometown, Liverpool. It just doesn't happen. But Lyon, it's a massive centre of population, not maybe the first sport being rugby. In fact, you've got a massive football team there, and you've managed to do it, which is really unusual.
Yeah, well, there's obviously Grenoble, who are pushing for top 14 as well in the Rhone area, and then Clermont, not too far away. So, you know, it is, you know, there's a lot of rugby fans around that area, and so. It is a big club now.
So where are your next steps, Carl? Where have you decided to go?
I didn't have anything coming from England, and I didn't really have any other options. And I got a call from Richard Hill in Rouen. And
is that who's there?
Yeah, he's been there. A long, long time now, and he's been.
Are we talking Richard Hill, ex Worcester, the scrum half?
Yeah. So he called me up and he said, "Look, do you want to come to Rouen? Rugby in Normandy, you know, wants to be bigger, and you know, really wants to go places. And he's got an ambitious president, and the club's really ambitious. And we'd like you to come and help us get up the league and probably there and." Hopefully one day get into the top 14, and it seemed like a really exciting project, and a bit like Lyon 5 years ago, you know, ambitious club, want to get up the league. And although, you know, Lyon had already been a top 14 club at that point, but it's still, you know, it's still an exciting project. And you know, they offered me you know, a long deal as well, which at this stage of my career is good. It's a lot of commitment from them, and hopefully I can go there and repay that commitment from them with performing on the pitch like I know I can.
Yeah, that is really interesting. When you told me about about your new deal, I did think exactly that, which is it feels a lot like where Lyon were. Do you feel in any way that, you know, that you've taken a step back, or that you've done this before and it's a real hard slog going forward?
No, I think probably that I did go through my head that people look at it and go, oh, you know, what's Carl doing? But I look at it from a long-term perspective as well, because, you know, I can go there, and if I perform well and do what I can, then, you know, I'm potentially post-rugby, you know, things could work out for me in coaching-wise and stuff like that. And you don't really know, you know, what else it can bring further down the line. And, you know, that's the way I was looking at it. And it's a chance for me to go somewhere where, you know, I'm going to have a big say in how they play and what we want to do. And that excites me.
Now, just before we came on air, I sent you a clip. We're going to have to talk about this because, of course, you're one of the few guys, well, not one of the few guys, you're one of many guys that were there, but you've been a little bit outspoken about it before. And the clip was from House of Rugby, the Joe podcast with James Haskell. And I can't remember his name now. How awful. Oh, dear. With James Haskell, I feel terrible now. And they're interviewing Sam Burgess, who had some, I mean, what was your immediate reaction to that? Because it was quite a jarring clip about the state of Bath and that team which you eventually left to go to Lyon?
Yeah, well, it didn't surprise me really, because, you know, when I was there, I actually a lot of it, what he said, it reminded me of, you know, my chats with Mike Ford and, you know, me telling him pretty much exactly the same, and in the pre-season before I actually left, you know, I said something similar to him, really, like, after what happened with Gary Gold, I didn't really, you know, want to play for him.
Yeah.
I felt you know, there was... It's not a jump on Mike Ford, like, day, really.
Jump on Mike Ford, you know, day.
He's got enough grief off Sam, but yeah, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, because you... I mean, when we spoke in the past, you are a very big Gary Gold fan.
Yeah.
So just tell me a bit about working with Gary Gold.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of players probably, you know, don't necessarily agree with how he wanted to play, or, you know, his systems in rugby. But for me, you only have to look at the squad he created at Bath. And that was destroyed within a year after he left. You know, yeah, you only have to look at that and the way he was an honest bloke, and, like, yes, you might not agree with what he was saying, but at least he was honest with you and you knew where you stood. And for me, if someone's honest with you and, you know, you're gonna show loyalty to them and stick by them.
Would you describe Mike Ford in the same way?
No. I personally felt that, you know, he would have other agendas as well, hidden agendas, and, you know, I feel like I'm a bit of an open book, really, and yeah, that's how I felt with Mike.
So I just find that really weird, the fact that he had, like, a hidden agenda, because I always think, like, if you're director of rugby at Bath, like, what more agenda do you need? You're pretty high up the pecking order anyway. You've got a great squad. If they, you know, if that Bath team had won a European Cup, or if they'd beaten Leinster, or if there's a different bounce of the ball in that Saracens final, he probably would be next in line for England anyway. In fact, you kind of think all he needed to do is stay in the Bath job for a little longer, and he probably would have had the pick of the England role anyway.
Yeah, well, it's mad though, because obviously we were winning, you know what I mean? So we were winning a lot, and obviously people didn't see that then. But, you know, I think we had a senior player group who were a bit embarrassing as well. Like, they just were pretty much yes men and just basically did what, you know, what Mike said, and didn't really listen to a lot of the voices in the team.
Do you think it was more a case of the wrong players were senior at the time?
I don't know, probably not, because you had, it's a long time ago now, we had probably Francois Lowe, George Ford, Rob Webber, a few other guys, but no, they probably were senior players in that squad, so no, probably not. I couldn't attack the personnel there, the right personnel there, but.
So I always think the shame about that Bath team, well, it's probably my favourite professional team in, since I've been covering rugby. I just loved, I loved the fact of where they played, loved the history of the club, I loved the composition of the team, I loved when they got it right, that, you know, the style of rugby that they played. Basically just everything about that team excited me. The size of the back row was pretty exciting.
Yeah, we had... Leroy played a lot of eight that year, and you'd have Francois Lowe and Sam, and then Matt Garvey as well, who started to play a bit more second row, because we had a lot of options in the back row. It's a hell of a team we had. Like, if you look back at it, it's like we had, you know, Paul James,
That's Rob a guy. Webber. Yeah, because that's a guy that is massively Wilson. Underrated. Paul James sort of left Wales and he was sort of okay. Like, we knew he was good. He came to Bath and just established himself as an absolute dominant scrummager.
Yeah, yeah. We had an unbelievable team. But unfortunately, it got a bit broken up.
How do you compare that team to the Lyon teams that have just have been around in recent years? Because, I mean, they're pretty exciting as well. And for all the stars that Bath had then, Lyon also had quite a lot of star power. I mean, including people like Freddy Michalak.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like Lyon, they've got a lot of good young French players. I mean, on the last podcast, I pumped the Lambie's tyres up, and he ended up proving me right, luckily. We've got people like Lambie, Baptiste Couillou. He played for France already, and unfortunately he had a bit of an ankle injury, and he's getting back to where he was. You've got Thibaut Regard, Dylan Cretin, a good young nucleus of good French players, and so they're in a good spot. They're losing obviously me and Liam Gill.
Where's Liam Gill going to?
He's off to Japan.
Is he?
A bit closer to... I think he is. I don't know if that's been announced yet. But
Maybe he's gone to... Maybe he's gone to Japan.
So I think he wants to be a bit closer to Australia.
What, 12? just the 12 hours away, yeah?
It's not... is it that? From Australia? It's not. It's about 6, is it?
Oh, I think it's about 12, mate. I think it's like going from like... Is it not like going from here to South Africa? It's a long old distance.
It's long, but I don't know if it's 12 hours. I'll check.
Yeah. So, just going back to the Premiership versus France a second. Would your preference have been to come back to England if there was the right offer?
Honestly, yeah. I wanted to come back to England. Yeah. But obviously, with everything that went on, and with the pay, with clubs giving players pay cuts, that it's pretty bad if they're seen to be re-signing players. And obviously, they started up now re-signing players. But at the time I was out, they were that's all I was getting from my agents. Clubs don't want to be seen to be doing business when that's going on.
It's mad. I mean, I can't. I mean, I'd be interested in your view on this, but I can't get over the fact that the clubs are just able to give players pay cuts of 25% and just say, well, that's it. Sorry, lads, you don't like it. Go somewhere else. I just can't believe
the thing is, they can't go anywhere else, can they? Because all the clubs have got together and said, don't steal our players. So players can't really go anywhere. So
allegedly, and I don't know this for a fact, so I could be spreading rumours here and whatnot, but allegedly the stance is they all agreed not to sign each other's players, which is madness.
Yeah, that's what I read as well. That's what I heard. So it's funny, isn't it?
Well, yeah. And the problem with that is, of course, it's one thing saying to an individual, we're not going to pay you any money, or the money that we owe you. But that's fine, because that's a breach of contract. You could go elsewhere. What's not fine is then to say to everybody, oh yeah, but no one sign anyone else's players. We'll just sort of collude and no one will sign anyone. Because ultimately, these lads are worth money in the open market, and they should be able to go. You know, if you've had a breach of contract in your player, you should be able to go somewhere else.
Yeah. It's like almost like a restriction of trade, isn't it?
It is. And I just can't believe that no one has fought harder.
Well, yeah. Well, that's the job of the RPA to help the players, is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got mixed views on them, though. I've always had a lot of respect for what they do in terms of welfare. But when it comes to pay and contracts, I can't help but think they're well in over their head.
Yeah, well, they do, like you say, they do a lot of good things and help a lot of people. But, you know, when I look at contracts and the security within them, and ultimately they're in the room with the RFU, making decisions about these things. I question whether they truly, have our best interests at heart. If, some of the clauses you hear about injured players getting released and things like that. I'd just want to have a real look at that. For me,
yeah, I'm with you there, because I don't think people realise that so much. But an injured player, I mean, if you're let's just think of someone. Well, you actually, if you're at a team, the chances are you're quite highly paid and you're probably a first teamer, and they're going to want to keep you around. But if you're not in that bracket, you get an injury. The injury clauses in the Premiership contracts, they're not actually that secure.
No, it used to be, I think they changed it, but it used to be like 6 months and they can flick you. But they've changed it now, I think.
Yeah. Anyone has fought hard enough for the Premiership players to make sure that they get what they owe. And also,
Would you think the best way of doing it would be to sort of get credit? Credit, so the club can say, right, we're taking this off you, we'll pay you it back when you start playing again? Or is that what you were thinking?
Well, basically, I mean, I think there should be a range of options. And I think the option should be something like, okay, if you accept your pay cut right now, we will give you your money back in the future when we can afford it. And I think that's kind of fair. You can see why it's a tricky situation. The clubs are missing their match day payments. Their match day income, although they've got all their BT income. Their TV rights are up. So if they get an increase in TV revenue, well, then they should pay back the players. Because ultimately, if those clubs are worth what CVC think they're worth, and then they go out and get more TV or a larger TV deal, all the owners that say they're losing money hand over fist, and I don't believe that they're not, but the capital which they own in those clubs has increased, and I don't see why it is fair that an owner can have a club and basically build the capital off the back of their players without paying what they have agreed to pay. That's what I don't get. And also, most contracts will run out in 2 or 3 years, so you can either borrow money to pay them, or you can dilute your shareholding to get some more investment. But there's loads of things you can do, and they've not done any of it.
Yeah. We're all on cuts in France, and I'm leaving Lyon as well, so I was happy with just to take the cuts and just for my contract to finish. I agreed to do it, but obviously, deep down didn't fully agree with it.
Yeah. What is the situation with the French players in the French league at the moment?
So they're on minus 25%, but all they're pretty much being, they're on sort of partial chômage, they call it. So the clubs, basically the government are paying the players and topping up the clubs. But then there's talk of them now continuing the 25% cuts into next season, and then the players are now objecting to that and trying to negotiate that down, is the last I heard.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I thought would happen in the Premiership, and that's exactly what happened, which is the 25% cuts started as, it's a temporary thing, and now they're permanent. And you think, it's just not right, particularly as everyone has it. I mean, nobody is employed in a rugby club who is on the playing side just on standard PAYE, just standard contract. And if they were, they'd be made redundant. But they could just go to a new employer. Because the clubs have cut off the angle for them to go to a new employer, and they've cut their contracts, it's just not fair. It's just not fair. And they would have run out of... Those contracts would have run out anyway, in which case you can then negotiate a deal on lower pay, legitimately.
Yeah, and another thing, going back to guys out of contract, you've got a lot of the Southern Hemisphere boys now coming back onto the market, which isn't helping.
No.
Guys are out of contract. So, there's even guys like Nick Abendanon, still hasn't, I don't think he's still not got anything, and a few other guys.
Is that right? How do you think it's going to pan out then? Do you think there's going to be a load of guys all heading to Japan? I mean, there's only, it feels like there's only a finite amount of places that rugby players can go. I wonder if we're going to see a stacked championship or something.
Yeah, but potentially. I mean, you've seen a lot of big signings in Pro D there recently. I think the cast number 8, Tulao, is it? Yeah. He's gone there, and a few of the big signings. So yeah, I think you'll see a lot of guys who are struggling to find deals, you know, go into the Championship or Div 2, or Div 2 in Japan maybe, and things like that.
Yeah, because, I mean, the guy who I interviewed not so long ago, Charlie Walker, found himself in a similar situation, which is nice little contract in Harlequins. All of a sudden, there's nothing on the table, ends up in Zebre for a lot less than he was on in Harlequins. And he's openly said that. And I just wonder, you know, if there's lads who are not getting snapped up like Nick Abendanen, or, you know, if someone like yourself not coming to the Premiership, you know, not everyone can go to Japan. I wonder where they're all going to end up. And then you've got the Australian lads too. Not to mention the South Africans are always looking for work over here because of the strength of their currency.
Yeah, and I've just thought as well, going back again to the cuts and things like that, what you're finding now is as well that a lot of the new players that clubs are signing, the players are signing deals that, you know, aren't eligible for further cuts. So
really?
So I think you're going to have a big problem when new players go into clubs and then the other players find out what they've been given cuts when the new players haven't. That's the next big problem, I think.
Well, I wonder, yeah. I mean, there must be some players in clubs who are immune from cuts, I would guess. I mean, if you want to keep your star, you might say to your stars, look, yeah, you're not going to get cut, but everyone else is. Because I guess the guys right at the top of the tree can go wherever. I mean, the marquee players can literally go wherever they want, unless they get rid of the marquee. No, sorry. They can't go wherever they want. They certainly couldn't move in the Premiership, but they could go over to France for huge money.
Yeah. So it's just another management thing for DORs to sort out.
Would you accept less money for less games out of interest?
Yeah.
What do you reckon that like the optimum amount of games is for lads to be playing nowadays?
I would say your very, very max would be 28 games.
I mean, that's still huge, Joe, isn't it? Would you include
it? It's still big, but you know, I'd probably, you know, but if a club's getting 24 plus games out of their big players, then they're happy, surely.
I would be looking something between 16 to 22, I'd say, including internationals.
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about when you first showed up at Sale and how the physicality is there, when you were first there, and then you think about what you see at the top level of the Premiership, Europe, and top 14 now, you know, it's moved on so much. I just don't think it's sustainable. Plus your international commitments, which is a level up again. I can't see how it's sustainable to go for 30 games a season.
So you reckon you'd go like player passport sort of thing? Like it logs all your games and you can only go to that certain amount of games?
Yeah, I think that it's a difficult one because either the squad's got to get bigger, but if the squads get bigger with a decreased salary cap, lads got to get paid less, which is a real pain. Also, I mean, if the international money continues to be a real big contributor, which it currently is. I mean, 20 grand a game is still a large amount of money for England. There's going to be a massive difference between how much the international lads are on compared to someone who might not be quite as good, but, you know, even like a good club player will be on substantially less overall. So I think
the middle gets squeezed a lot, though, eh? The middle of the game's getting squeezed. And quite rightly, the internationals get paid very well because they're internationals and they're very good. Mm. But like you say, the out and out club player is probably arguably more valuable than an international player for the club in terms of the amount of games they play. They really are getting squeezed at the minute. So
yeah, I mean, that's a good point. So in terms of internationals, I wonder if I was a DOR at a rugby club, whether I would pay more money for someone like John O'Ross, just off the top of my head, because he is the captain, plays every game, and he's never going to get called up. Or I would pay for an Owen Farrell, who is amazing when he plays, but you might not see him for half the year. I wonder if the clubs are going to break it down more like that.
Yeah, well, I personally reckon they should central contract the England players. And then, obviously, I just think that'll work better for me.
Yeah. Just on that, how did you get on with trying to play for France? Because you did have a little bit of a laugh and a joke about it at one point. Did you ever pursue that seriously?
Yeah, well, I genuinely did, yeah. At the time I was playing well, and I thought, I reckon they'd want me here, because I looked at a lot of the back row at the time, and for me it was, there was a big chance that I could actually do it. But then I think me playing like 2 minutes against Canada in the Churchill Cup, I think it scuppered me.
Yeah, nightmare that.
But so I played a grand total of something like nine minutes, and it tied me to England.
Nine of the most expensive minutes of your life.
Yeah. I'm not saying I would have got there, but I would have liked to have been given the chance. I don't think they'd have picked an English bloke, though.
They might have. I mean, they picked plenty of New Zealanders. Well, I think of one.
Yeah, but not the English, mate. The crunch. There's no way they would have let an Englishman play for them.
I was about to say Richard Paul Jones did it, but I got confused. He never did. He played for England, but was one of the first guys in France. Did you actually speak to anyone from the FFR?
No. I just spoke to my agent. I said, can you, work out? Because I knew that I'd played in them games, and I had the suspicion that would have tied me. So they just got back and said, yeah, I think you're cooked.
Yeah, it's annoying that, because they can only nominate one team at a time, can't they? So Mike Haley is a great example, who played both A team and played, I don't know, whatever it is, 21s or whatever it is, 20s or whatever it was. And they can only nominate one capture team. So although he's never been a full England international, everyone assumed he was captured by either the 20s or the A team. But because they switch it around and nominate it at different times, he sort of avoided it and now can play for Ireland. It's mental. It's mental that he can do that. And, well, I guess he's got slightly more Irish heritage in him than you've got French heritage. So there is that as well.
Yeah. That was a funny phone call, that, though, with Eddie. It was good to get communication from them, from England coaches, really, in that period, because when I was in England initially, I remember the first time I got called to play for England, it was off the back of a stag do in Magaluf, and I had no idea I was on the radar, and he called me, and Lancaster called me after 7 days on the smash with my mates eating KFC at 2 a.m. And I ended up getting a phone call from Flanny saying, do you want to come down and play against the Barbars at Twickenham? And in my head, I was like, I should say no to this, because after all that I've done, being out on the stag do, I said, I should say no to this. But I ended up saying, I'll come down, because he said,
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
No, you'll just be on the bench. And then I went down and first day in training, Callum Clark gets injured and he says, "Oh, Ferns, are you starting?" So ended up starting in the worst shape of my life.
Yeah, and then
I got, to make things worse, I got a yellow card.
So, like, they always say about the Barbos team, you know, for that week that the Barbos are together, they have a hell of a time. But for England, I guess it's actually quite serious.
Oh yeah, it's real serious, yeah. So I went there and obviously turned up, and then in hindsight, I should never have went because I just got labelled then like unfit, fat, horrible, like So it wasn't great for me, and it took me about 3 years to get back in the frame. Then after that.
Bloody hell! Did you manage to carry much?
A little bit, yeah. But I ended up getting a yellow card. And you know, I've only ever had 5 yellow cards in my whole career.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, for a back row, it is pretty disappointing. Yeah. I ended up getting, and we lost. I think Freddie was at 10. Freddie Michelat was at 10 for the Barbos that day as well, and we lost, and I think it was the first time they'd lost in ages. Yeah. And then I was just like that's me not playing for England for a long time after that.
And do you get any feedback after a performance like that? Do they just say, "Oh yeah, well done," and the phone never goes, or you know, how do you get a sense of what's going on in the coach's minds?
No, I didn't really get much feedback back then. That was the most disappointing thing, because wasn't really in communication with them or getting feedback. And like I say, going back to Eddie, at least he, you know, he's in communication, and you were getting feedback and where you thought you stood. So you know, that was really good. I obviously disagreed with a few things he said on the phone.
What did he say to you on the phone which you really disagreed with?
I was fuming at the fact when he called me a whinger and a moaner, because I said, "Look, mate, I'm not a whinger and a moaner. I left Bath after being in a Premiership final to go to the second division of France, and then and at the time I said, now I'm the best number 8 in the top 14. I said that's not whinging and moaning. I could have sat at Bath moaning about it, but you know, that's taking big risk in my career and doing something about it.
And
you know, I think, well, didn't really have much to say back to that, because it's all true. So, but ultimately, you know, I'm not stupid. You know, he's ringing me because he would want me to come back and fight for a place. So, you know, but ultimately, I felt the best decision was to stay in France at the time.
Yeah, because obviously, you know, you signed that rather infamous deal now with Gloucester, which, you know,
yeah.
It turns out you might have made the right decision.
Well, yeah. Well, when I did the U-turn, in my head, you know, I was like, you know, I'm going back for pretty much half the pay. You know, yes, if I play for England, I can earn more. But you know, if I get an injury and I'm at Gloucester injured. Which turns out I actually did. I ended up doing my ACL again about 2 months later. I just felt that would, if I was at Gloucester injured, then it would break me, to be honest, knowing that I could have been back over there on double what I'm on, pretty much. Turned out it was the right decision, because I did my ACL for the second time about 2 months later.
Because that England money, or the thought of the England money, is really nice. But actually, you know, what stops you from being the next Nick Azikwe or Luther Burrell or any of those things? Tamona Harrison, who is a fine, fine player. I like him a lot. But, yeah. You know, he has one bad half. You never see him again.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I'm not going to put that in the hands of someone else. You know, yeah, yes, I could have come back and no doubt the form I was in, you know, I'll say now I would have got an opportunity. I would have definitely got an opportunity because I was playing, I was the best number 8 in the top 14 that year. And if I carried on the form, I would have got the opportunity. But, you know, it's not all in my hands. Like, yes, I could have worked hard and did everything I could to be in the best shape, the best.
You're absolutely right. It is not in your
hands. It's not all in my hands. So I didn't want to go back and, you know, put it in the hands of Eddie.
And that's the thing, really. I think that's a kind of unfair position to put a player in, which is come back, but you've got to do these things which will be detrimental to your career. But, hey, you might get an England place. And if you get as many caps as, say, Chris Robshaw or someone like that, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. But you just don't know, do you? And it just takes a change of coach or it could be anything.
Absolutely, because it's not like, like you say, it's not like I had 30, 40 caps behind my name. You know what I mean? I didn't have any caps at the time. It was a big decision. It was a tough decision, mate. It was a horrible time in my career, really, because, you know, I grew up, you know, wanting to be an England player and played all through the age groups, you know, played 20s. And you know, I grew up, that's all I ever wanted to be and ever wanted to do. And it was a horrible decision, really, I had to make.
Yeah, I bet. So at the time of Gloucester, there was a lot of speculation. It wasn't just speculation, but like, wow, they've offered you a big deal. So was the situation with Leon just, look, we've come this far, we want to really, really consolidate. Here's even more money, because they didn't give you that deal to start with, did they? Was it only after they realised that you were going that they stepped up?
Yeah, well, I think. Well, it was stupid from Leon because they had I was this Leon player and then they let me sign for someone else and then re-signed me. The whole thing's an absolute joke, but I said, look, I'm going back to England, and they were right. Well, that's what we're offering you. I was like, okay, I'm going. And then I carried on playing really well and I had a big game against Racing, ended up scoring 2 tries and. We won at home there, and then I was just with my mates are over as well at Leon, just having a good time. And next minute, Pierre came up to me and was like, look, we'll give you this. You're not going anywhere. You know, we want you to stay. And I said, right, well, if you get to that, then, you know, it's going to be an awkward situation, but I've got to stay at that. And then at that exact the next day, I went to Gloucester and said, look, you know, I tried to do it as well as I could. You know, I said, look, you know, I don't really want to come back. They've offered me this. I want to stay in France now. Can you come to some agreement with Leon and then I'll stay there. And so that, then it was left with the clubs, and they went back and forth, and it got to the point where I was going, and then I wasn't going, and I was going, and all my house was packed up, and then I ended up having a meeting with Humphreys in Manchester, and I said, look, you're being totally unreasonable now. Like, I've told you what I want to do, and I've tried to help you as well, getting. You know, a good fee out of Leon, and you know, you're being unreasonable now, and I don't appreciate that, and then it ended up all getting sorted.
Yeah, it's a strange one for me because, you know, obviously I can't on one hand say it's disgusting that the clubs don't pay their contracts, and then on the other hand say, yeah, Carl, well done, you were right to renegade on your contract.
There's a big difference with some players, like one of their players actually, Mostar, he just signed a deal with Leon and then upped and went. I've gone about it. Tried to go about it in a professional way to help, you know, both parties get, you know, obviously Gloucester get a bit of compensation, and then Leon keep me. You know, I've tried to
I guess the difference is you don't want a player who doesn't want to be there, do you? That's the big difference. You know, if you're going to spend big money on a big signing, you've got to make sure that they really want to be there. Otherwise, it's not going to work for either party. I think that's the bigger difference, really.
Yeah, well, you know, for me, I totally made the right decision to go to Gloucester. You know, if I was going to go to England, for me, Gloucester was the destination I wanted to be, because, you know, the rugby in the Southwest, awesome. They are a big club, and fan base is awesome as well. And so, you know, it definitely was from the options I had that year, you know, to come back to England. You know, Gloucester was the right fit, because as well, I thought they were a lot better than they were putting out at the time as well. So I could go in there and make a big difference.
Who were the toughest DORs to negotiate with, and who have you negotiated with in the past?
Oh, I haven't really negotiated with many. I haven't negotiated with any DORs really. It's only that one meeting that I had with Humphreys, and just said, look, like, that's the only time really I've sat down and negotiated with the DOR.
That's interesting. So you don't get phone calls like, hey, Carl, I hear you coming on the market. Do you want it, like, just testing the interest?
Oh, yeah, you'd have things like that, but you'd never really speak numbers with DORs or stuff like that. Keep that to your agent, back to the agent side of things.
Because I always had a funny feeling that you might want to come back to Sale at one point.
I think would have been ideal, but I think I'm not South African, am I?
So. Are you big enough though?
Yeah.
They were going through the stage of signing a lot of players just after Simon had invested his money, I thought that'd be a decent signing, actually. That would work. And it did turn out that they do like buying lots of back rows.
Yeah, well, yeah, I don't know what it is though, mate, because, you know, I feel like I'm still playing well. I played against Leinster in the Champions Cup and ended up carrying like 100 metres against. And for me, they're one of the best defences in Europe. The best defences in Europe, if not the world. So, you know, I'm still, you know, still effective, and for me, there's still a lot more to come for me as well, because I'm still battling back a bit from the knock I had as well. So I'm getting better each game. I don't understand it. I still feel like I've got a lot to give. And
do you think there's almost like a feeling that you might have priced yourself out of the market? Because, you know, you are a big player in France. You do have a contract large enough for you not to go to, you know, a good contract in Gloucester. Do you think there's a perception of how much it costs to get French players back over?
Yeah, there's definitely. I don't know whether I priced myself out of the market, because I don't know fully what my agent initially priced me at. There's definitely a perception, yeah, that, oh, Carl's in and that in France, there's no way he'll come back. I think that's maybe what happened a little bit as well.
I think that happened a little bit to Steph Armitage. Like, I mean, he was obviously on great money, doing wonderful things at Toulon, but there was an impression that if you want Steph Armitage to come over and play for you, you're gonna have to pay a lot of money. I mean thinking back about that, that's a name that a lot of people have forgotten, and they forget how good he was for so long, and for him not to play for England, That's unbelievable, actually.
Yeah, well, I made it clear that, you know, if I was to come back to England, then, you know, I was fully aware that I wouldn't be on anywhere near the money I'm on in France. I fully understood that. It was mainly just because, you know, my family are going to be living in the UK now. I would have liked some option there, but it didn't come, and obviously now I'm, looking forward to that Rouen challenge.
Now, obviously, you're off from Lyon. Lyon had an unusual number 8 situation, and as I understand it, they now have an unusual number 8 situation again. Bastereau is back at Lyon, right? And will he be taking your place as a number 8 from now on?
He will. he will be playing number eight. Yeah, I think that was all done ages ago. You know, when he had his initial stint in Lyon and then ended up going to New York, he was always going to come back to Lyon. So I was aware of that. I think he'll play eight. They just signed Gallin from Toulouse.
Right. I'd just be interested to know your thoughts then, really. I mean, I've hardly ever heard of a back moving into the pack, particularly one as high profile as Bastereau. What do you think of him as like as an eight? What does he do well? Is he gonna go and do a good job in one of the most competitive leagues in the world from there?
I think he'll do all right. I think what he'll need to learn is organising sort of men around him, because especially in that Lyon team, the eight has a big role in which you organise your props around you, and some of the props aren't very intelligent footballers, let's put it that way. So, you know, you have a big job in your hands in the middle of the park, trying to dominate that area, and I'm sure he's an intelligent footballer, Bastereau, and he's a strong leader as well, so I'm sure he'll do all right.
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a huge fan, and one of the reasons I was such a big fan is he was so unusual. So from that 13 channel, on certain lines that he would run, I honestly believe he was the best in the world, and also, I think, on his day, unstoppable. But I also think that the things that made him really good and unusual at 13... they're not that unusual, actually, in the pack. Like, he's not unusually big for a forward, or unusually fast, or unusually anything, really. Not that he's unusually fast as a back, but, you know, he looks like a forward anyway. You know, the advantages that he had no longer seem to really stack up so much.
Yeah, I think he'll do all right as well, because a lot of Lyon, they'll probably use him off, like, starter plays and off line-out and stuff like that, so he'll be... straight into it there. It's more just like the phase play, getting into pods, and because you got a bit of a free roll as well at eight, so it's just all that phase play stuff he'll have to, I'm sure he'll, get his head around.
Yeah, and without being particularly disrespectful here, Lyon weren't exactly using you in the lineup much, were they? So it's not like they have to reinvent the scheme.
No. An old coach said to me, jump like a tin of salmon. That's how I jump. Yeah, no, I don't want to be around the lineup. I want to be in the back line hitting the ball up, or inside or outside 10 in defence. That's where I want to be, really.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a little bit about your time at Sale, because obviously it's obligatory that I do that. But obviously you were there a long time before Sale got good again. Were you around just after the? I guess you were around just after the glory years of the Premiership final, right?
Yeah. So basically, my first year. There's a funny story actually, because I trained with the first team when I was 17, and I ended up doing this field session with them, and I was running around like full contact, tackling everyone, Shabal was chasing me around trying to get me, and then I had Wigglesworth saying in his harsh mank accent, like, "Oh, you're not a Twickenham now, lad," and stuff like that, and I ended up going into the change room after that, thinking, "Oh my God, I'm going to have to move clubs. Everyone hates me." And then next minute, the door bursts open, and Dean Schofield's there, going, all right, our kid." I love that. I love keep doing that. I love that. And then, I went from thinking I had to move clubs that everyone hates me, and then Scoey came in and sort of,
Scoey's absolutely class.
Yeah.
I think he's actually still playing, believe it or not.
Is he?
Yeah, I think... Well, he definitely played last year. He played for Stockport last year.
No, he was on my stag doing... I don't... I don't think he's still playing.
I'm telling you now, mate. If it wasn't last year, it was the year before, but he's definitely played for Stockport, because I got a text from him asking what the Broughton Park team was. He didn't know that I'd moved to Toc H. But then I read the team sheet and it said Schofield. I assumed it was his son or something, but no, it was actually him.
Right. Yeah, because I was there when they won. So the year after they won it, and then we had like a year before Fleetwood Saint-André pretty much decided to take all our stars to France, and then luckily enough we had quite a strong academy, which sort of helped. The first year we still had, you know, stars like Charlie and Wiggy and stuff like that. They hung on for another year, but then we lost a lot of that team to French clubs, and then we luckily just survived. I think we finished just above Leeds one year and luckily survived. And then we had like Brewer come in, and that was brutal, like some of the stuff.
I've heard that he is actually brutal. Like
it was brutal. Like he'd be screaming at David Tate and Belly, saying like, you know, your P45 is in my office. This is in front of everyone. Go and get it in my office. So I remember Belly stood up and went, "Go on then, let's go and get it." and then they just went into the office and it was just chaos. Just like calling boys out in videos for just nothing. Like, so there was one where he called David Tate out and said like, "Watch David Tate here. He's a lazy bastard. Like, look at him. And he just basically did exactly what you should do and go like north to south. Like when there's a kick.
Yeah.
So instead of honey potting around the rut, you go north south and, you know, keep your space. And that's what he did. And he ended up just destroying him in this meeting for no reason. And then, you know, there's loads of examples like that. But there's one day we had a rule that if you were late, you'd write your name on the board. And I was late one day, and he was like, "There you go, mate, go and write your name on the board." So I went and got the pen and wrote my name on the board. And we had another meeting after a meeting with the forwards, and Brewer hadn't turned up for about 5 minutes. Oh. And all the lads were like, "Fernsy, you'd never tell him to write your name on the board. Write his name on the board." I was like, yeah, well, one of them. Like,
of course you will.
I'll definitely do it. And he came in and I got the pen and went, "There you go, mate, write your name on the board."
Did he?
No, he went berserk. He was like, "Oh, fuck yourself, Fernsy. Don't ever fucking speak to me like that." And he was like, "I'm in here at 5 a.m. and but it just went off it. So then I just went, "All right," sat down like a little.
Yeah. So you don't want to. So you don't want to write your name. That's what I'm saying. Unbelievable. I wonder if like. So I always think about how do you motivate a rugby team, particularly like when you've got guys like yourself in there, who are just, you know, massive brutes who've always played the game and not really scared of anything. How do I make them do what I want? And I kind of think that sometimes it is that Brewer mentality of just screaming your head off. But then on the other hand, I think you do look a little bit insecure by doing that.
Yeah, well, ultimately it's the, you know, like Sam touched on it on the podcast. Ultimately it's the players, you know, having a common goal and going out and doing it for each other. You know, you can have one of the worst coaches in the world and have a good tight knit group of players and they're going to do well.
I just got, I think you've either got to dominate a rugby team or you've got to coerce them. I don't think you can be like in between. You can't let the, you know, that team of alpha males get on top of you, and you can't sort of be seen as a joke, I guess, is the...
Why can't you be like vulnerable?
I just don't think you can. I think the nature of rugby itself, you're always looking for vulnerability. So whether it be lads in the changing room, whether it be out on the field and you're trying to pick holes in the opposition, I mean, that's basically part of your job is to look for is to look for vulnerabilities. And if you feel that someone's either a fraud or, you know, I think rugby teams are incredibly easy to lose, and the more competitive they are, the easier they are to lose. Do you think?
Well, no. For me, I just think if you have a top relationship with the coach, and he does show some vulnerability, and then you show some vulnerability, and
yeah.
you know, that relationship grows, and that's when you start going extra miles for blokes. You know what I mean?
I agree with that. Like, I think what I'm saying is, I think there's basically two ways of doing it. There's the absolute domineering way, and I'm not sure that is always the way.
That never works, mate.
Or, well, you know, I think Steve Diamond's quite domineering, isn't he, in his own way?
Yeah, but then what of Sale 1?
Well, I think by the end of the season we can rack up a trophy. Something will happen. Something will happen. And, you know, they're getting somewhere. But on the other hand, you see the Rob Baxters of the world, and they do it completely differently. But as I always say, not everyone can be Rob Baxter. If they could, they would all be doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I actually heard one about Mike Brewer, which was they were doing lineouts before a game, and I can't remember what they got wrong, but they got something wrong. Instead of trying to correct the lineout, he goes, "That's shit. Everyone stop. If that's shit now, you can be shit on the weekend." And sent them all and sent all the lads back to the changing room.
Yeah, you told me this story last time, and I didn't remember it at the time, but now, like, after that, I did remember that, I think, because it was Rousey. Used to run the line out, and he did do that. He was a good coach, to be fair, in terms of how he wanted to play, and he did. I remember that.
Who's the coach that you've got on well with best throughout your career?
Neil Hatley at Bath.
Yeah.
I felt I got on well with. A coach that I didn't necessarily realise, you know, was huge for me at the time was Kingsley Jones at Sale, because he really sort of accelerated my career, really, and gave me a lot of opportunities at Sale, and really pushed me forward. Kingsley's huge for me.
I bet a lot of lads would say that, because the amount of young talent that came through Sale around your time, whether it be you, Briggsy, is Foden a bit older than you?
Yeah, Foden's older than me, yeah.
Yeah, so Foden, I mean, Wigglesworth, I know he is older than you, but I mean, at the time, what was he? He might only be like 3 or 4 years older, right?
Yeah, at the time he left, he was still only young.
Christian Day was fairly young when he left. I mean, the list goes on. The list goes on and on.
Yeah, Gaskell as well.
Christ, people forget about him. Like, I think. Yeah. He was the youngest club captain in the Premiership when he was at Sale.
Yeah, well, he was captain when Brewer was in charge. I just remember another story. I remember we played Wasp at home.
Yeah.
And Charlie Hodgson scored all our points. It was like 35. We lost in the end, but like, it was because basically Charlie, we were winning, and Charlie's gone to clear our lines, and he's missed touch by like a centimetre or something, and they caught it, returned it, and ended up keeping the ball for ages, and then they won it with a penalty or something like that.
Yeah.
And Charlie had scored all our points, and he came out in the press and said, just bagged Charlie.
That's unbelievable, isn't it?
And just absolutely rinsed him. And that's one thing you don't do is attack Mr. Sale, so...
Yeah.
You just, from that, I think the next day he might have been gone, I think.
Well, when was that? So when would you say the most enjoyable part of your career was? Because obviously you've been through the full range of it. Would it be something like at the very start, when professional rugby would be very exciting and you're playing with all those guys at Sale? Or a bit, you know, more like when you're getting a bit more senior at Lyon, with a bit more of a say and so on and so forth?
Yeah, probably the Leon stint, because you're obviously a bit wiser and you've got a bit more responsibility, and you just know the crack a bit more, so you can enjoy it. Whereas, yeah, like when you're younger, and I definitely was. I was a bit like, didn't really stop and think. Just to, like, I'm into it, and you know, I didn't realise that, you know, you can take your time a bit, and that rucks, the ball's not really going anywhere for that.
It's yeah.
Like, you know, half a second. Whereas when you're younger, you're just there, and you're probably there too early, to be honest.
Yeah, it sounds quite sad, because obviously I'm getting on in age now. I'm all of 36. And I look at the lads who are at Sale now, like the 19-year-olds who are just sort of making it in. I was like, it must be awesome to be them now. Just kind of getting into rugby, getting a fairly good paycheck.
Single.
Get it right. Yeah, exactly. Single, being paid to go to the gym. It doesn't get any better, really.
No. To be fair, like living in... we lived in a rugby house in Derbyshire Road in Manchester. That was awesome.
Who are your housemates?
So it was Mark Jones, Salam Kwadi, and Garth Dew.
Who? So I know Mark Jones. Who were the other two?
Salam Kwadi.
Oh, the winger.
And then we had Garth Dew. So it ended up. I made the big mistake of trying to get an online degree during that period, because I went in there and with the intentions of doing a sports science degree, and quickly realised I was kidding myself.
Yeah, degrees are overrated anyway, mate. Massively overrated.
Yeah, we enjoyed ourselves. There's the story. I wouldn't say that story, but we enjoyed ourselves.
Excellent. Mate, it's always a pleasure chatting, and I'm glad that we managed to get something on tape pretty good. You're pretty active on Twitter. Why don't you tell everyone where you are?
I'm on @Carl_Fairns on Twitter. I'm trying to start. I'm not really using that as much as I did now.
It's hard, isn't it? It is hard. Yeah. You go on there and it's nonsense which is going on. It's just unbelievable. But somehow I stick with it because... You know, you meet some good people through there as well, which is always important to remember.
Yeah, well, definitely. I did actually shut it down, but then I reopened it, and I actually had someone sort of contact me through it, and you know, I ended up helping them out a bit. So you know, I ended up keeping it open, because you know there is options of people trying to reach out to me if they want me to do something. So.
Yeah, I tell you what, I got rid of it. It started COVID. I thought, right, that's it. You know, there's too much nonsense. I thought this COVID thing's going to be far more serious. And then it turns out, not that it's not serious, but I don't know. I had visions of a dystopian future, and Twitter wasn't involved in it. And for that week, my house was immaculate. I was up to date with all my admin. Bills were paid on time. Improved on trumpet playing. Like the opportunity cost, which is sunk into Twitter on a weekly basis, is unbelievable.
Do you play the trumpet, do you?
Of course, I play the trumpet, Carl. Of course.
How did I not know this?
I took it up last year. I what happened is, I was cycling home, and I just thought, do you know what? No, actually, I'll tell you what actually happened. I was in Rome with Phil and Tim doing egg chasers. We went to watch Italy versus All Blacks. And we got quite drunk in a bar on Negronis, and some guy was doing jazz on his trumpet. I thought, that's really cool. As soon as I go home, I'm going to get a trumpet. And I was cycling home in December. I was thinking, do you know what? I'm going to go and get that trumpet now. So I took a detour from my cycle home from Oldham, went into Manchester, and on the spur of the moment, picked up a trumpet, and I've been playing ever since. Still rubbish, but I do enjoy it.
Now you need to go to a France-England game and play that. That one.
Yeah,
you're not tune you do, and then everyone goes, hey,
yeah, I will not play it in public yet. When I say it, I'm not very good, I'm not lying there. I'm not being falsely modest. I really am not very good.
What grade would you say you are? Like, because there's five grades, isn't there?
I am doing my grade one. As soon as we can do grades again, I'll be doing my grade one.
Because did you know what? I'm a grade two saxophonist.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
You still playing?
No, I'm not still playing. So I basically said to myself, right, I'm going to learn the Simpsons theme tune and then quit.
So my thing was I want to learn the Egg Chasers theme tune, which is the Washington Post March, and I've got fairly far with that actually, but I quite enjoy it. Well, why don't you pick it up again?
I might do. Now I'm in Rouen by myself, so I'll have a bit of time, so I might do.
And also, isn't Lyon like the jazz capital of France?
I know it's the food capital. I don't know whether it's the jazz capital.
I think it might be, because when I looked at flights over there, I made a little map of where places to eat and places to go drinking. It seems to be they've got a lot of jazz bars.
Right.
I haven't been in one, but
I usually just stayed around Brotto. There's a few good clubs around there. Plastic Rattle.
Well, yeah, you should continue to play, mate. And you should continue to get that Simpsons theme tune done.
Yeah, I will. Definitely.
Excellent. All right, mate. Well, thanks again. And we'll chat soon.
Yeah. Cheers, mate. See you in a bit.
All right, mate. Cheers. Thanks for that call.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.